Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The FDA recently confirmed testing in 2017 found toxic PFAS chemicals in food in a number of states, including Delaware, raising more alarms about the risk these chemicals pose.
The advocates will tell you that it absolutely adds to the urgency of this because it is additional evidence that these chemicals are pervasive.
Contributor John Hurdle has more on what the FDA testing found and the reaction to it. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear about increased efforts to address historic preservation issues in Newcastle County. Plus, Arts Playlist puts the spotlight on a new summer music festival. And we highlight more student work from Mount Pleasant High School and our Generation Voice youth media program there. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. There's been a fair amount of coverage nationwide and here in Delaware about the extent of groundwater contamination by toxic PFAS chemicals. The chemicals are increasingly being linked to some cancers, as well as low birth weights, elevated cholesterol, thyroid problems, and other illnesses. Just this month, a handful of Blades, Delaware residents filed a lawsuit against several companies, including DuPont and Chemours, that they blame for contamination of the town's drinking water with the chemicals in 2018. We've previously reported on the issue in Blades and questions about PFAS groundwater levels around both Dover Air Force Base and the Delaware Air National Guard Base in Newcastle. But now there are a new set of concerns being raised in the wake of recent news that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration also found PFAS chemicals in some foods. They were found in several states, including Delaware, during testing done in 2017. Contributor John Hurdle dug into this story for us last week in a piece you can find at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me this week to discuss what we know and don't know. Let's start with the FDA report on these PFAS chemicals found in food. What did this report find?
Well, it found that there were these PFAS chemicals present in 14 of the 91 samples that the FDA took in 8 states, including Delaware, in October of 2017. Now, they have, since their initial report, the FDA has slightly amended that figure. I mean, they'd initially said that there were 10 out of 91, they found the chemicals in there. They've now upped that number slightly. But the kinds of foods that we're talking about include 10 kinds of meat and fish. Other foods, including sweet potatoes, lettuce, even chocolate cake, was found to have that in particular had a particularly high level of these PFAS chemicals, and then they also found them in a series of leafy greens. This was in a separate series of tests, things like kale and spinach, and they were and cabbage. And those some of those results were positive, and they were taken downstream from a PFAS production plant somewhere in the eastern U.S. They didn't say where.
What, if anything, do we know about what was found in Delaware?
Well, unfortunately, really very little. The FDA has not specified where it found these chemicals in Delaware or in any of the other 8 states that make up its the FDA's Mid-Atlantic region. So unfortunately, we're still waiting for details on that.
What reaction did state officials you talked to have to this information, and kind of, you know, piggybacking on that, what is the state currently doing to address PFAS contamination in general?
Well, I think we should point out here that there's a growing gap between states that make their own or are in the process of making their own regulations on these chemicals and those that do not and rely on the federal government for the federal government's advice on the appropriate health levels. Now, Delaware is in the latter category. It does not set its own limits on PFAS chemicals, whether they be in food or drinking water. And so they so that the DENREC follows the lead of the EPA on this, and the EPA's the EPA issues guidelines. They're not requirements, but they're just what they call a health advisory limit for just a couple of kinds of these chemicals in drinking water, and a lot of advocates for tougher regulation of these chemicals say that the EPA's guidelines are actually too lax to protect public health. Nevertheless, DENREC continues to follow those levels, and they say that they will continue to work with the EPA to set what they call maximum contaminant limits for those particular chemicals.
And that's more or less they didn't have a specific reaction to what the EPA found in terms of food, correct?
That's correct. Yes, that was their only response.
Now, you've noticed noted in previous reporting that Delaware Senator Tom Carper has taken up this issue of PFAS contamination, and he has been trying to push the EPA on this issue, particularly on drinking water. Remind us what he's trying to accomplish and how he's reacting to this news of contamination in foods.
Well, after the FDA report came out, Senator Carper issued a statement using this new evidence of PFAS in foods as opposed to drinking water. I mean, we should say that most of the campaigning and most of the state regulation on this issue so far has been on the issue of drinking water, which is why it's interesting that we now have additional evidence that these chemicals are showing up in food. In any case, Senator Carper used this FDA release to try to gin up drum up support for several bills that would curb these chemicals in various ways. One of these bills calls on the EPA to speed up its proposed regulation of the two chemicals that I mentioned before. Another bill would designate PFAS as hazardous substances. So he's hoping that this new evidence is going to increase congressional support for those bills.
You mentioned that for the most part, the advocacy on dealing with PFAS to this date has dealt with water, water quality, water supplies. And now we're seeing it in food. Is there any sense of how these chemicals are getting into the foods that they were found in?
The FDA did offer some pointers on that. They talked about the contamination of water, contamination of soil. They also pointed to a possible source through food packaging. And what advocates say about that is that some food packaging is manufactured in countries that do not control PFAS in their industrial processes, and so that is a possible source of that's a possible reason how the chemicals kind of got into food. Another issue here is that of sewage sludge. Now, this is kind of an unsavory topic, obviously, but that is the residue that's left over from by wastewater treatment plants after they've processed sewage, and this so-called sludge is used spread on agricultural fields as a fertilizer in some places, and it's not subject to federal regulation, so. So farmers can use this without it being tested for any PFAS content. But there is now one state, Maine, that any sludge used to be tested before it goes on fields, and so that's an indication that there is that there's growing concern that about that as a source of this contamination.
Is there any sense of how much a threat this PFAS in food is at this point compared to, example, for the threat it poses in water quality?
Well, the FDA said that even though it found these positive results in a certain number of foods that it tested, it's unlikely to be a public health threat. I mean, it was the FDA is very clear on that, that it doesn't see this as a risk to public health. Now, the advocates for tighter restrictions on this thing say that even very low levels of PFAS, whether they be in water or food or anywhere else, do have the potential to hurt, to damage human health. And there's a long list of health conditions, as I think you mentioned in your introduction, Tom, including various kinds of cancers, high cholesterol, and even low birth weights, developmental problems. And so a lot of people are sounding the alarm on this at various levels. And what the advocates will tell you is that the EPA continues to drag its feet on this.
What do we know about the amount of testing that the FDA is doing on this issue? Are they continuing to test? Is this something they're kind of continuously looking at?
Well, yes, they are. They put out an additional statement on this just on Tuesday, following up their report where the evidence of this of the food contamination came out. And what they said in this latest statement is that yes, there is more work to be done. They've set up an internal work group. They're working with state and federal partners on how to deal with this, and they're sharing this with scientists overseas because this is not just a U.S. problem. I mean, we should say that on the state level, some of Delaware's neighboring states are being increasingly active on this issue. New Jersey, for example, is a national leader on regulating PFAS in drinking water. It's in the process of adopting some very tough limits on at least three of those chemicals. And Pennsylvania, which until recently was, I guess you might say, also dragging its feet on the issue, is now in the process of setting up its own. It's begun the process of setting its health limits, saying that it wasn't going to wait any longer for the federal government to get on the case.
And you mentioned in your piece that, you know, the way this information came today was somewhat interesting. It was presented in a poster at a recent conference in Finland, which was then photographed by an environmentalist, then sent around and published by the Environmental Working Group, a nonprofit that campaigns for these tighter curbs on PFAS chemicals. Did the FDA offer any reason why it hadn't released this information previously, that it had to kind of come out in this kind of, you know, not official way?
Well, it's a good question. And no, they did not explain that. But what they have said since is that the that even though these samples were collected in 2017, they weren't analyzed until this year. Now, why it takes the government 2 years to do an analysis of this kind, I don't know, and I think that we would like to know. But that latest statement gives this a somewhat more up-to-date slant on this.
And finally, you know, based on the people you've talked to, how much does this new information raise the level of urgency to address PFAS here in Delaware and elsewhere nationwide?
Well, I think the advocates will tell you that it absolutely adds to the urgency of this because it is additional evidence that these chemicals are pervasive, and what the scientists will tell you is that the chemicals are present in nearly everybody in almost in a high 90% range of American citizens that can be found with these chemicals with traces of these chemicals in their blood, and so you know if And the other point to bear in mind here is that the other point to bear in mind here, Tom, is that these chemicals were designed not to break down, and therefore, even though they are not widely manufactured or used anymore by U.S. companies, they're still persistent in water supplies and, as we now know, there's some food supplies as well, because they don't break down in the environment. And so that's one of the reasons for the continuing concern here.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. His piece on PFAS chemicals found in food locally is available at DelawarePublic.org. Next, contributor Larry Nagengast joins us to look at work to improve historic preservation efforts in Newcastle County. Stay with us. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We've previously reported on historic preservation in the First State, more specifically, what appears to be a shaky track record on the issue, with buildings such as the old Forwood School in Brandywine 100 falling victim to neglect and becoming beyond repair. But some Newcastle County Council members are trying to improve the situation, creating a new working group to address it. Contributor Larry Nagengast takes a look at that group and what it hopes to accomplish in his latest piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And he sat down with me earlier this week to discuss it. Let's start with the working group itself. Who's behind it? Who else will be a part of it? And what's driving its formation?
Okay, well, it's a loosely organized group. It's a combination of members of Newcastle County Council, some managers in county government, especially from the Land Use Department, some preservation advocates, and some interested citizens. It was organized by Dee Durham, who was elected to the council last November to represent Western Brandywine 100 and the Greenville area. Working closely with her is John Cartier, the councilman who represents Eastern Brandywine 100. And Cartier, for years, has been the council's strongest preservation advocate. And Durham, who is known primarily as an environmentalist, worked years ago for Preservation Delaware, the nonprofit advocacy group. Durham was driven to start this group because the county was virtually powerless last year to stop the demolition of Walker's Mill, which is a 200-year-old structure on the Brandywine that was originally home for the area's mill workers. And of course, it's in Durham's district and fairly close to her home.
Broadly speaking, what kind of things does this group feel it can have the county do to avert situations from getting out of control and essentially kind of beyond help?
Well, you know, the important thing to realize here is that Newcastle County, with so many unincorporated areas, doesn't typically have a lot of historic structures in close proximity to each other. I mean, Old Newcastle is an exception, of course, and the city of Newcastle, which has zoning responsibility for its own territory, takes historic preservation quite seriously. But, you know, if you're looking at Brandywine 100 or Hockessin or Pike Creek or the areas below the C&D Canal, you know, you've got a one-room school here, an old farmhouse there, a mill by the creek, and a church on top of a hill. And as Dave Carter, a councilman from the Middletown area, points out, you know, if you had 15 historic buildings in Old Newcastle being threatened, there'd be a big ruckus. But if you know, if you get 15 buildings threatened and they're spread out all over the county, it's a lot harder to rally support to preserve them. So now to go back and kind of answer your question a little more directly, you know, the members of the working group are looking for ways to make sure that the owners of these properties take good care of them and don't let them fall apart. And they're looking at both carrots and sticks. Carrots like grants or possibly tax breaks, and sticks like stronger laws and tighter enforcement of existing regulations.
The county already has some tools that it can use in this effort. Why aren't they necessarily working at this juncture?
Let's talk about, first of all, the best tool that they have is something that's called historic overlay. It's a special zoning category that offers protections for historic properties that are placed within these zones. Now, there are something like 900 properties in the county that are either on the National Register of Historic Sites or eligible for that listing. but there are only 40 historic overlay zones. So you can see right there that there are a lot of historic sites in the county that aren't protected by this historic overlay zoning. The county also has a historic review board, but its power outside of these historic zones is limited. It does have the ability to delay the demolition of a property, of a historic property, for 9 months, but it can't stop a property owner, most often a real estate developer, from tearing down an old building and putting up something new and profitable in its place 9 months later. And then the county's got something that's called a resident curatorship program, basically letting people move into historic buildings owned by the county if they promise to take care of them. But there are a couple of hitches here, and this is why some of the reasons why it's not working. The county expects participants to put in at least $150,000 on improvements to these properties if they move in, and there's no way that these the resident curators can get any kind of return on their investment when they inevitably move out. So the county's got some tools, but there are some fairly obvious reasons why they're not working.
And as we've seen, even some properties that are owned by the county can't seem to avoid neglect. Can you tell us a little bit about what the county has tried to do in some of those cases and what isn't working in those efforts?
Okay, kind of a mixed bag here. I mean, in some cases, as in on county parkland, the county has actually torn down some old buildings, old barns and the like, historic structures that for whatever reason they chose not to maintain. And then they've offered up some of their buildings for these resident curatorships. But as I said, the conditions written into the program have resulted in limited interest. You know, now in one case with the Jester Farmhouse in Brandywine 100, the county has found an alternative to the resident curatorship. A nonprofit group wants to move in there and create an art center and art gallery. And the county and the organization, they tried to do the resident curatorship program, and it was just too many hitches and hassles there. So now they're wrapping up a lease arrangement, and the deal that's being cut is that the county's going to spend some money to fix up the building's exterior, and the nonprofit's going to put up about $100,000, and maybe a little more than that, and they've raised close to that amount already, to do the improvements, the essential improvements to the interior, the heating, ventilation, air conditioning, the essential interior systems. And then if all goes well, this facility, which then be called the Jester Art Space, would open sometime towards the latter part of next year.
And while many of the cases we've talked about so far, and you've talked about in your piece, are in northern Newcastle County, specifically Brandywine 100 area, there is one that's playing out right now south of the canal, southern Newcastle County. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, well, this debate concerns the Houston House, which is a farmhouse in the Bayberry development, which is just north of Middletown. And it's another example of what the preservation community calls demolition by neglect. A developer doing next to nothing to keep an old building in decent shape, and then applying to the county for a demolition permit, which is almost always granted, and usually with that 9-month delay that I mentioned. And in this case, when the developer, Blenheim Homes, filed official plans with the county, it promised to keep the farmhouse standing. And now that was about 15 years ago. Meanwhile, it did little to protect the building, and it finally got around to putting a fence around it after some vandals had gotten in and done some damage to it. So now Blenheim is saying it's an eyesore, it can't maintain the house any longer, so they want to tear it down. And not only do they want to tear it down, they want to build 5 more houses on the site. Now, the residents in the area, most of them anyhow, they feel that they're trapped. It may be too late to repair the building and keep it, but keeping it standing would create a nuisance in the community. Those who wanted the farmhouse saved are doubly upset because they think the developer is taking advantage of his own neglect by building more houses to make more money. Now, if the county had stronger laws and procedures, perhaps this wouldn't happen. Let me give you some examples of some other possibilities here. Chester County, Pennsylvania. Builders there are required to incorporate historic structures into their communities as they plan them. And they've often made these older homes centerpieces rather than eyesores in their new communities. Now, if the county held developers to their promises, and if they regularly inspected these properties, episodes like this one might also be prevented. And if the county made it a policy not to authorize construction on the site of demolished properties, developers would have one more reason to maintain the old buildings.
You point out in your piece that no matter whether the property is privately owned, like the one you just mentioned, or publicly owned, like some of the ones that are on county property, oftentimes this really always comes down to money. Can you explain how this dynamic tends to work out in these situations?
Well, you know, I talked to Michael Emmons, who's an architectural historian at the University of Delaware, and on the private property side, you know, he puts this quite succinctly. Private property rights in this country is almost like a religion. Okay, so if a property is privately owned, what happens here is that the developer is going to say to the government in one way or another, or to the community, you know, if you really care about this old schoolhouse, how much are you willing to pay to help me keep it up? And then, of course, if it's a building that's owned by the county or any government agency, then it's typically, ultimately, a budget issue. So, you know, the government looks at the site and says, okay, we got to take our pick here. We got to make some choices. Are we going to fix the old farmhouse, or are we going to pay for another police officer or two, or are we going to raise your taxes? So the decisions aren't easy. Hard choices are going to be made, and quite often the outcome is the disappearance of a landmark that is an important part of a community's heritage.
So your piece does point out there are a few specific possibilities that this working group may pursue going forward. First, tell us a little bit about what the county can do from the governmental side to bolster preservation efforts.
Okay, well, a couple of thoughts here, and we'll just kind of rattle them off. They could expand these historic overlays to cover all of the sites that are now on the National Register or eligible for inclusion on the National Register. They could automatically impose the historic overlay on any property that has a historic structure on it as soon as a developer files a plan to build a new community there. They could offer tax breaks or grants to the property owners to cover some of the cost of maintaining or preserving historic structures. They could revise the guidelines for the resident curator program to make it more appealing to people who might be interested in living in these structures. And they could also give the Historic Review Board more tools to encourage preservation and to prevent demolition.
Beyond that, outside of the governmental realm, what else could possibly be done to maybe make this a little bit more of a priority?
Well, I guess, you know, public awareness can really be a major positive influence. When residents are more aware of their community's history, the more likely they are to support its preservation. So let's tell residents about the historic tax credit program that the state offers so that it's not used primarily by big developers. Let's collaborate with outside organizations, Preservation Delaware, for example, that can provide advocacy, expertise, and some additional financial resources. You know, but the biggest thing of all just might be to lead by example. I mean, every preservation advocate I spoke to in researching this story said essentially the same thing. If the county isn't going to take care of its own properties, it's going to have a very difficult time telling private citizens what they can and cannot do with theirs.
Having said all that, is there some optimism that the county can get a grip on these issues and save some properties in time to make a difference before more of these properties are too far gone to help?
I'm glad you included the word some in your question. Yes, there's some optimism about the ability to save some properties. How much, how soon, I'm not quite sure. Dee Durham talks about picking the low-hanging fruit first, but it's going to take a couple of meetings of this working group to figure out which apples to choose first. Right now, we've got three members of the county council, Durham, John Cartier, and David Carter, who have strong interests in preservation. As for the rest of the 13-member council, well, preservation hasn't historically been one of their priorities. So it's hard to gauge what level of support the working group will have when it does develop some proposals. I'm not saying that the rest of the council is opposed to preservation. It's just something that they really haven't put much focus on in the last 10 years, even more than that. That said, there's a lot of expertise here in the county, in the state. There's volunteers, and in particular on this working group, volunteers from Preservation Delaware, experts from the university, architects, historians. They've got a lot to offer, and working together, they should come up with some good ideas. And here's another reason for hope. Kevin Canico, the Bayberry resident who's fighting demolition of the Houston House, is a relative newcomer to Delaware, and he's never been involved in a preservation battle before. So, you know, this is his first try at digging in on this. So, you know, our farmhouses are evaporating, he told me. I've got a young family, so saving the local heritage is part of my future. Now, if enough people realize the importance of connecting our past to their own futures, there's a much better chance that something good is going to happen.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time on The Green this week. You can find his piece on the newly created Newcastle County Historic Preservation Working Group online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next, our latest arts playlist tells us about a new summer music festival coming to the Wilmington area. Stay tuned for that here on The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. A brand new music festival is coming to Delaware this summer. It's called Seraphim Summer Music Festival, and according to its organizers, it fills a void left by the Delaware Chamber Music Festival, which was discontinued after its June 2017 concerts. Gus Mercanti is manager of the Seraphim Summer Music Festival, which will feature 18 accomplished artists from around the United States in 8 separate performances. Mercanti recently spoke with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about this 10-day festival and gave a little sneak peek of his festival performance.
Gus, thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
All right, Seraphim Summer Music Festival, what's it all about? It sounds exciting.
So the Seraphim Summer Music Festival is a brand new festival that's happening, as you said, this summer. We start on June 20th. We go until June 30th. And all the concerts are held at the Music School of Delaware in Wilmington. And if folks are familiar with the chamber music scene in Delaware, particularly in Wilmington, you might know that we had the Delaware Chamber Music Festival. And while we're not replacing that festival, we are filling the void that they left when they discontinued after their 2017 season. So there's a real need for this festival, and we're just so excited to bring it. We have 8 concerts and 18 artists from around the country coming to do these 8 very diverse programs.
All right, can we talk about some of the artists? There's a lot of them, I know, and I don't want to leave anybody out, but what can we expect if we go to this festival?
Absolutely. So we're going to hear repertoire ranging from string quartets and other combinations of all strings, but then we also have instruments coming. We've got, of course, one thing I will say as a singer, I'm delighted that we're including some vocal repertoire in the festival. We have Eileen Grisky, wonderful flute professor and player from University of Delaware, and Chris Nichols, who's the clarinet faculty at the university. So we're doing rep for strings, but we're also incorporating other instruments.
And all of these artists, Gus, right, are coming from really around the United States.
Absolutely. Not everyone is coming from out of town. I'm going to maybe guess here that probably 25% of us are local. And you're right, the rest are coming in. Various universities where they're professors. Some of them are strictly freelancing. But yeah, we really have a good mix of folks coming in from around the country, as you said.
All right. And let's talk about the themes, because each concert will have a unique theme, correct?
Absolutely. So we start the festival, as I mentioned earlier, on June the 20th, which is a Thursday. And that's our Bohemian Gems theme, as you pointed out. We have an Out of Bavaria theme that's coming at the end of that first week. And, of course, that speaks for itself what that is. We open the second week with French Foray, which is a fun play on words a bit because one of the composers on that concert is Faure himself, but all the other rep is French as well. So we're really just having a lot of fun. I can't wait to hear Finale Fireworks, but I also love fireworks, so we'll see what that one brings.
Now, you said you are a singer. What will you be performing?
Thank you for asking. That's great. On the first week on the, let's see here, it comes on our second concert, Friday, June 21st, when we have the It's Classic theme. I have the pleasure to do three Schubert selections because one of the larger selections on that program is the Schubert Trout Quintet. And so we're going to include the Schubert setting of the Trout Quintet, but for vocalists. So we'll be able to hear it sung, and then we'll be able to hear it played on the second half.
I'm going to put you on the spot. Can you sing a little bit for us?
I don't know. It's at 9 in the morning, but we'll see what we can do here. Let's see.
Just something short.
Oh, it doesn't necessarily have to be from the Trout then?
No, of course not.
Oh, you know, in the second half, the second week, I'm going to sing some French. And why don't I do a little bit of that?
There you go.
Great. Dans la forêt que crée un rêve.
That is beautiful. Gus Mercanti.
Oh, you're so nice. That's a small, this is actually the opening line of Saint-Saëns' setting of Clair de Lune, The Moonlight.
All right, we're talking to Gus Mercanti. He's the festival manager. How can people get tickets? Where can we get more information about this festival?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking. If you could go right to our website at seraphinensemble.org, you're going to see a big banner across the top, big, beautiful, colorful banner, and that's where you can click to get the summer. It actually says right there on the banner, Seraphin Summer Music. And again, that's Seraphin. I'm glad I've been working with Kate. She always clarifies that's with an F. And this is where I would normally look at her and say, you have to tell them about Seraphin because it's so cool. I'm going off script here a bit, but Seraphin with an F is the gentleman who made the violin that Kate plays. And so we always hear Let the Bright Seraphim or something where we're thinking of angels. But this is Seraphin, S-E-R-A-F-I-N, seraphinensemble.org. And you'll see the, like I said, the banner across the top with the Seraphin Summer Music information.
Yeah, we want to clarify for everybody. Yes. Gus is talking about Kate Ransom. We've talked to Kate several times here on the show. She is a violinist, a great violinist, and she will be performing as well in this festival. Go on, Gus. I cut you off there.
No, well, you cut me off because I always forget that you know, when things are out of context, people are like, what? So thank you for, I'm new to this, so thank you for filling that in for me. Seraphinensemble.org. And the other thing I want to point out is that all eight of the concerts are at the Music School of Delaware, the Wilmington branch. That's also listed there on the website. You have a link right there on our website to go for tickets. We do have a nice ticket package where people can order one ticket, or we have a little four-pack. Or if you want to go for all eight, you can do that as well and have a nice discount. As the festival manager, I feel it's my duty to say, why not just get the 8-pack? And then if you can only come to 4, fine, give the other 4 away. But it makes great financial sense to do the 8-pack.
Make a great gift, too.
It sure would. You know, we're always giving gifts out, not just that time of the holidays. So it's a great, happy summer present to give to your favorite neighbor or your wonderful coworker or, I don't know, your favorite radio host.
There you go. Hey, Gus Mercanti, he is the festival manager for the Seraphin Summer Music Festival. It's coming up on June 20th through the 30th. Did I leave anything else out? Do you want to let anybody else know anything else about this festival?
The only thing that comes to mind that I would want to say is I think it's important to note that we've got energy behind this, from the community, from our sponsors, from the participants. I just always want to point out when people give me the chance to chat and say, I love the art scene here in Delaware. I love the whole area, but I love the art scene here in Delaware. And I mean up and down the state, to clarify. And I'm probably preaching to the choir, but when anybody looks at me and says, oh, there's just nothing to do here, I think, you know, you're just not looking, because we are constantly putting things out there and people show up because people in Delaware love the art.
Thanks to Seraphin Summer Music Festival Manager Gus Mercanti and R. Kelly Steele for bringing us this week's Arts Playlist. There's a link at DelawarePublic.org with more about the artists performing at this festival and how you can get tickets. And stay with us. The Green wraps up with Enlighten Me and more student work from WMPH at Mount Pleasant High School in the Brandywine School District, part of our Generation Voice Youth Media Program. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. In this week's Enlighten Me, we head back to WMPH and Mount Pleasant High School in the Brandywine School District, one of the two schools we've partnered with on our Generation Voice Youth Media Project. Students there and at our other partner, WMHS, at McCain High School in the Red Clay School District, produce a whole host of interviews and features throughout the year. And once again this week, we're showcasing one of the student interviews with a local music artist at WMPH. The one we have for you this week is from Tori Rupert, who is wrapping up her freshman year at Mount Pleasant. She sat down with E.B. Hawkins.
Hey, I'm Tori, and here interviewing with me is E.B. Hawkins. E.B. Hawkins is a singer, guitarist, writer, producer, and engineer. E.B., who is part of a band, E.B. Hawkins Band, and a solo artist, is based out of Chatts Ford, Pennsylvania. E.B. Hawkins Band has various artists sitting regularly. E.B. has had the chance to travel all over the world, and you can even hear how some of his music sounds travel-inspired.
I listen to your music that we play on WMPH, like the song Tor Eiffel, and it sounded kind of like travel-y to me, so I'm wondering if you've been able to travel a lot.
I actually have done a lot of traveling, and some of it translates out into that sound, and some of it didn't. It's pretty much whatever you do in your life comes out in your music.
So where are some of your favorite places you've been?
Oh, heavens, that's a long story.
Oh, wow.
I'm very fond of Greece. I'm very fond of New Orleans. I'm very fond of Nova Scotia. I've spent a lot of time in France. There are probably a million more.
EB is not a guy who likes to be compared to anyone else, so his music is definitely nothing you've heard before.
Who are some of your favorite artists, and do you think they've shaped your music in any way?
I am certainly on record as saying that not much of anybody's ever shaped my writing or playing, because I've spent the majority of my life with a morbid fear of being boring. And being boring is not necessarily immediately attributed to playing stuff that sounds like other people, but I've found since I was probably 18, maybe younger, that if I played something and I recognized it because I'd heard it before, that I would extract it from my vernacular so I didn't play it because it sounded like somebody else. To me. So I've had, as I said, really a morbid fear of being pegged as sounding just like somebody else. There are numbers of people that I really admire, typically people who are extremely renowned in their fields and play magnificently further than I do, you know, and I listen to them, but I've really never tried to copy anybody. I've done everything I could to avoid copying anybody.
What is your major goal for your music?
I can't imagine that I have a good answer for that. I think just keep writing it and try not to lose it. You know, it'd be great. It would always be wonderful to have your music played all over the place. I hope people enjoy it. But interestingly, I do it. It's a very selfish craft for me. I don't think of it selfishly, but typically if you said to me, you know, if you walked in and said, I don't really like your music, I'd say, thanks. It's nice to see you. Mm-hmm. You're still pretty. You know, I mean, it wouldn't, I don't really do it for, I've never really done it for reflection. There are people, there are artists who are very exaggeratedly attached to audience reaction. Mm-hmm. I just never really have been, and I'm not saying that I think there's a problem with it. Interacting is great. It's just never been what stirred me to do it. And you know, what matters to me is I get to play with fantastic musicians and have moments with those people playing music that most people don't spend a minute like that in their life. And I get to do it a couple hours a week, you know, typically. So I don't really, but the goal, I guess, is to stay healthy and do it for another 40 years. Forty years. And because it's really, it's my drug of choice. It's what I, it's what I love to do.
Lastly, what is next for you and the band?
That's an interesting question. The Calypso Twins, as we referred to a minute ago, that is basically an outcropping of the E.B. Hawkins band.
Hey, Susan.
Hey, E.B.
What day is it?
I don't know, but we're at Patchum in Paris.
That'll work for me.
The E.B. Hawkins band is a somewhere between 4 and 8 piece, sort of a rock band, pop band.
You never believe me, but I love you only.
People ask me what kind of music I play, and I usually say not the stupid kind, because it's a band that, you know, the structures are modestly complex, and there's no, you know, there's no yo, can I get a yo, you know, and. It's not really what we do, and I have a, to say the least, a great excuse to take that band out in about 2 months for the Buggy Tavern reunion, and they've asked me to bring an outshoot of the band that I played there with, you know, 35 years ago. So I'm working putting that band back on the street. And I'm excited because I'm working with some of the original players, and I'm working with some very exceptional young players. I'm working with a young man at the moment who's really, really a spectacular guitar player, and I'm real fond of him, and he's in that project. So that's the next thing that's different. I've probably got, you know, 35 dates in the next 6 months in various incarnations of, not necessarily the E.B. Hawkins band, but I do a bunch of different projects.
Yeah.
So we'll be busy.
E.B. Hawkins.
Well, thank you.
Well, it's completely my pleasure.
Someone is you. Oh, I intend to be independently blue. Say I want your love. I don't want to borrow. Have it today just to give back tomorrow. No, your love is my love.
Thanks again to Mount Pleasant High School freshman Tori Rupert and E.B. Hawkins for enlightening us this week. A reminder, interviews like this one are part of Generation Voice, our collaboration with the Brandywine School District at Mount Pleasant High School and its radio station WMPH, and the Red Clay School District at McCain High School and its radio station WMHS. Our youth media producer, Sophia Schmidt, oversees Generation Voice for us and worked on interviews like this one with teacher Paul Wishingrad, who runs the career pathway we work with at Mount Pleasant. That brings us to the end of this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributors John Hurdle and Larry Nagengast, Mount Pleasant High School freshman Tori Rupert, and Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.